first half of the course. Gong will take over for the second half of the course. So this course is Quantum Field Theory 1. And our main goal for this course is to unify special relativity and quantum mechanics. So these are two of the most successful theories of nature we have. Special relativity describes things when they're moving very fast. Quantum mechanics describes small, and we'd like to be able to use both at the same time. We have fast-moving objects that are moving quickly and are small particles. So that's one obvious realm where we'd like to be able to use both special relativity and quantum mechanics. And the way we can combine these two theories is in quantum field theory. An obvious question to ask is, why do we need fields? So I'll give a few motivations for why that is in a second, but I just want to also point out that quantum field theory is a broader subject that has applications beyond where special relativity is not important, for instance, in some condensed matter systems. So it's a broad subject. We'll be focusing more on the particle physics applications, but most of the techniques we'll be using and developing have broad applications in wide ranges of physics that you'll see some of those applications in future courses, like condensed matter course next month. Okay, so this is our goal, to combine these two theories. The claim is we need fields to do that. And let me just give you a few reasons why that's the case. So one of the simplest things we could try to do is we could try to take one of the simplest quantum mechanical systems we have, quantum mechanics of a single particle, and just make it special relativistic. So, and in tutorial, you'll try to do that tomorrow. So the basic assumption where special relativity will come in is we'll just assume that the Hamiltonian acting on a momentum eigenstate just gives us the energy times that momentum eigenstate. So if we assume this in single particle quantum mechanics, we'll find an inconsistency. And before I say what that inconsistency is, I just want to make a note on units. So throughout the course, I'm going to use natural units. Where h bar and c are both set to 1. So that's why there are no factors of c in this equation. In these units, energy and momentum and mass all have the same units. If you prefer to use unnatural units instead, you can always restore these factors by doing dimensional analysis. For instance, energy as units of kilograms per meter times meter squared per second squared in KGS units. If we want to restore the units in this equation, we can just do that by saying, noting that we're missing a factor of meter squared per second squared over here. So if we want to restore the C, we just do it in the familiar way. Okay, so first of all, are there any questions on this unit system? We'll get practice using it throughout the course. So if we make these two very seemingly innocuous assumptions, assuming we're doing single product quantum mechanics, which is something we do all the time when we're first learning quantum mechanics, and assume that the energy eigenvalues just take the relativistic form. What you find, and you'll show this in tutorial tomorrow, is that if we compute the propagator, that is the amplitude for a particle, say, at the origin, to travel to some position x in some time t, is non-zero, even outside of the light cone. So this means that in single particle quantum mechanics, a particle can travel faster than the speed of light, which is a big problem if we believe that information can't travel faster than the speed of light. So you'll show this in tutorial tomorrow. And another word on my notation. So since we're almost exclusively going to be dealing with relativistic systems, most of the time we'll be working with four vectors. Sometimes we'll be working with three vectors. So the arrow over the x indicates this is a three vector. And whenever I write an x with no arrow, that indicates that it's a four vector. And in the lecture notes, which I'll post immediately after each lecture, three vectors will be bold, also in tutorials and homeworks, and four vectors will be italic. Okay, so it's a very simple attempt to unify special relativity and quantum mechanics. Doesn't work. It says that particles can travel faster than light. Okay, so that doesn't work. So one of our assumptions here has to be wrong. It is possible to unify special relativity and quantum mechanics. And the resolution involves particle number non-conservation. So it's a bad idea to assume that we're working in single particle quantum mechanics if we want to deal with a relativistic system. And why is that? So let me give you a loose argument for why we might expect, in general, when we combine quantum mechanics and special relativity, that particle numbers is not conserved. So we can imagine working in a box size L. So suppose we've got a particle in a box of size L, cubic box, dimension L in every size. So the quantum mechanics tells us there's going to be some uncertainty in the momentum. We know something about position. And well, special relativity says that, remember we're using units where C is one, that momentum and energy and mass are all more or less the same thing. So for a particle that's moving relativistically, the momentum is approximately the same as the energy. So the m squared term will be negligible, and energy can, as Einstein taught us, can be converted into mass and back. So if these three quantities are all the same thing, there's an uncertainty in the momentum, then the mass of the system can change. So if we start with a single particle, it's not necessarily true that we'll always have a single particle. So in particular, if the energy is greater than 2m, we have enough is much greater than 2m. So suppose we make the box very small. So 1 over L is much greater than m. Then we can get pair production. So this has not been a very careful argument by any standard, but it just meant to suggest that pair production is a very generic phenomena once we combine special relativity and quantum mechanics. And in fact, that's true. Almost any quantum field theory you can write down does not conserve particle number. Okay. So there are a couple of possible routes we could take at this point. So our goal is to combine these two theories, quantum mechanics and special relativity. We thought a little bit more carefully, we would come to the conclusion that we want a little bit more than that. We could construct some systems that obeyed quantum mechanics and special relativity, but were still very strange in that they didn't obey the usual locality properties we'd expect. And so it's typical to, or desirable, for our theories to have an additional property known as clustering. And what clustering means is basically that local experiments are unaffected by the distant environment. So what results we get for a measurement if we do an experiment here in Waterloo shouldn't depend on what's going on Alpha Centauri. That's not implied by quantum mechanics and special relativity, but it's certainly a property that we expect any reasonable physical theory to obey. And the name for that is clustering, or the cluster decomposition property. So these are three features we'd like our theories to have. And we could imagine trying to, from first principles, build up a theory of quantum fields. And well, there's no proof that the only way to theory that possesses these properties is quantum field theory. There are some arguments that suggest that it's pretty hard to get anything else. And I'm unaware of any other theories that possess these properties besides quantum field theory. So this is one possible route we could try to build things from the ground up. And then, of course, if we have a quantum theory of fields, we should be able to take a limit and recover classical field theory. So this is one possible route. It's not the route we're going to take. This route is more technical than the one we're going to take. And it would take us a long time to get to perturbation theory and relevant techniques that we'll need for later courses in the year. So we're going to take the opposite approach. We're going to start from a classical field theory. And describe a procedure by which we can quantize classical field theory. And then we'll show that the quantum field theories we get satisfy these properties. So in this course, we're going to take the bottom route. But there is some, at least some understanding about going the other way. Okay. So the claim so far is that quantum fields avoid this property of superluminal propagation. There's other reasons that you might expect that if we try to combine special relativity and quantum mechanics, we might want something like a field. And that reason is that, so in classical physics, for instance, classical electrodynamics, fields are introduced in order to avoid action at a distance. So the first thing you learn in electrodynamics is the force law between two forces. But that's really kind of an incomplete description. It says that there's a force if you have two separated charges, and that force just depends on the distance between them. A more complete description you learn later on in your electrodynamics courses, electromagnetism courses, is that the forces between two separated point charges is due to a field. Each charge creates a field around it, and that field is what interacts with the other charge, creating the force between those point charges. So in that way, a field, the introduction of a field avoids action at a distance. The two separated charges don't instantaneously affect each other. They affect each other only through the intermediate field. And so the same sort of argument, we want to describe things locally. We expect fields might be able to help the quantum theory. And we'll find that, in fact, they do. So in classical physics, to avoid action at a distance, we introduce fields. Also works in the quantum theory. And so our starting point going to be classical fields. And so particles will arise naturally in this formulation as the fundamental excitations of a field. And quantum field theory explains a number of puzzles in ordinary quantum mechanics. So one thing QFT explains is why identical particles are identical. In other news, redundant statements are redundant, but the meaning behind this statement here that identical particles are identical is in ordinary quantum mechanics or without quantum field theory, there's no reason why every single electron is exactly the same with exactly the same charge, exactly the same mass, exactly the same spin. But that question is answered by QFT. QFT says that all electrons in the universe, everywhere for all time, are excitations of a single field, the electron field. And so it gives an answer to this question that maybe occurred to you, maybe didn't, but why are identical particles identical? Additionally, QFT explains the existence of antimatter. Okay, so the fact that quantum field theory is based upon the idea of fields means that all of the interactions are local. That's part of the reason why we're introducing fields in the first place. And so the interaction between any two particles or more than two particles can be described via local interactions. So for instance, if we have a proton and a neutron that are scattering, and so here in this diagram, I've drawn time going upwards and some spatial direction going sideways. This is our first example of a Feynman diagram that we'll discuss in much more detail later in the course. So quantum field theory says that if we have two particles that are interacting, like a proton and a neutron, those interactions occur via local interactions. So at some point in space, slightly redraw this. Some point in space-time can describe or approximate this process via the emission of some particle that's emitted from this proton that changes into a neutron, goes over here, and is absorbed, converting this neutron into a proton. And let's say it's emitted at some space-time point x, absorbed at some space-time point y. So if it's emitted from x, proton has a positive charge, neutron has a neutral charge. So the particle emitted over here has to carry off the charge. We say this is some positively charged particle and call it a pi plus. And over here it's absorbed, converting the neutral neutron into a positively charged proton. So that's some process that can contribute to proton-neutron scattering. But if our theory is relativistically invariant, then we know there's also, we can also describe this same process in a different frame. Assuming X and Y are space-like separated by a diagram like this, where the first Y occurs before X, and so the intermediate particle is emitted before it's absorbed. In that case, it's traveling in this way, and the flow of charge, this has to be a negatively charged particle in order to conserve charge at this vertex. So in that case, here we have a pi minus that's emitted from this vertex and travels over here and is absorbed to cancel off the positive charge of the proton. So basically, locality and special relativity tell us that we have to have two oppositely charged particles. If you want to be able to consistently describe this process via a local exchange in a way consistent with relativity. So antiparticles are really a necessary part of quantum field theory.
Why do X and Y have to be space-like separated?
They don't have to be in general. So we'll consider, when we do this carefully, we'll see that there are different cases where they could be, we could have describe these interactions where the mediating particle interacts with two of the particles at some point X that's time-like separated for some point Y. But we'll also see that we're forced to include cases where the mediating particle interacts at two space-like separated points. It's related, it's actually closely related to this fact that basically the propagator, single particle propagator, doesn't vanish outside the light cone. So almost the same calculation you'll do in single particle quantum mechanics in relativistic quantum mechanics in tutorial tomorrow will carry over to quantum field theory. There'll be one crucial difference, but it's still going to be the case that that particles will have, in a different sense than here, non-vanishing propagator outside the light cone. It won't violate causality when we include quantum fields, but there'll still be a sense in which we have something that looks very much like this propagator, doesn't vanish outside the light cone, which is basically what's telling us there that we have to include space-like separation. Bati?
What about the mass conservation? In one frame, photon is sending some particle. In the other frame, neutron is sending. Sorry, proton is sending one particle. In the other frame, neutron is sending another particle. Would that mean those two particles have, one of them has negative mass?
So this particle here, this one I've drawn by a dotted line, is what's known as a virtual particle. So for a real particle that we can observe, we have p squared, which is e squared minus p squared equal to m squared. So this is true for what's known as a real particle. In other words, a particle that you can observe in the laboratory. This particle here, that I've drawn by a dotted line, is not a real particle. It's not observed in the laboratory at the beginning. So imagine measuring our system at the beginning and at the end. So this is what's known as a virtual particle. In a sense, it's a calculational tool we use to describe the interaction of these, but in many senses, it's also a particle, but the key difference is that It does not satisfy this condition. It won't satisfy P squared. Yes.
Are we using the plus, minus, minus, minus metric?
Yes, I was planning to introduce that later, but now is as good a time as any to our convention. Let me write that somewhere else. Is that the metric is mostly minus. So this is what's known as the West Coast metric, partly for historical reasons. So I chose this metric for a few reasons. One of them is that this equation looks a lot nicer without a negative sign. Second is that the majority of the textbooks I recommended on the wiki use this convention. And it makes things slightly simpler for what we're going to do in this course. In QFT2, we'll switch and use the other metric, which is by far the superior choice when you're doing the topics we'll do in that course. I'll say a little bit more about that later. Okay. So, okay, and the QFT also explains very mysterious from the perspective of non-relativistic mechanics connection between spin and statistics. And in fact, there's a theorem called the spin statistics theorem, which says that integer spin particles must have Bose-Einstein statistics, and half-integer spin particles must have Fermi-Dirac statistics. So I won't say much about this in my half of the course, but Gong will say a little bit more about spin statistics theorem in her part of the course. Okay, so these are three big successes of quantum field theory, conceptual successes, besides its innumerable and unprecedented, really, in the history of human science, experimental successes. So besides these reasons that are conceptual triumphs of quantum field theory, some quantum field theories, such as quantum electrodynamics, which we'll learn more about in this course, have been tested to unprecedented accuracy, better than 1 part in 10 to the 10. So no other theories in the history of human thought have been tested as accurately as quantum field theory. Some particular quantum field theories. Okay. So, given that we want to study quantum field theory, and our approach is going to be to start from a classical field theory, you can imagine at least two possible approaches. So what we want to get to is Q of t. The approach we're going to take in this course is called canonical quantization. So this is the basically a generalization of the familiar procedure from non-relativistic quantum mechanics of taking a theory, Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, and promoting the generalized position and conjugate momenta to operators that don't commute. So we're going to do essentially a generalization of that to go from a classical field theory to quantum field theory. Another approach you could imagine taking is known as the functional integral quantization. And it's essentially a generalization of path integral formulation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics that you learned about last month in your quantum theory course. And this is the approach we'll take in QFT2. So both approaches have their advantages and drawbacks. Canonical formulation, which we're going to develop in this course, has some advantages that include the connection between the fields and particles are more clear when we're dealing with canonical quantization. And also importantly, there are a number of exact results that we'll go through in this course that are much easier to demonstrate using canonical quantization. And some of these exact results will be essential for developing perturbation theory, which is going to be one of our main goals in this course. On the other hand, functional integral quantization also has its advantages. Spin one particles are much easier to deal with in the functional integral formalism. And also, non-perturbative effects are, for the most part, easier to deal with in this formulation, too. So by the end of these first two courses, you'll be familiar with both approaches, which each have their uses. Okay. So that at a broad level, that's what we're going to do. We're just going to take a classical field theory and promote the field and the conjugate momentum to the field to operators. So we'll be dealing with field operators. And remember, our goal is to get a relativistic theory. And so before we attempt to do this, it's useful to think about how we treat time and space in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, position is what?
Operator.
What about time? Time is a parameter, right? So in quantum mechanics, x is an operator, time is a parameter. So they're treated very asymmetrically. And this seems like a very terrible idea to treat them asymmetrically if we're trying to develop a relativistic theory that treats time and space the same. So we want to change this. And well, you can imagine there's two options. You can either promote time to a operator or demote position to a parameter. So first option, so we can promote time to a parameter. To an operator. This would work. We could develop quantum field theory in this method. The difficulty would be that we would still need a parameter for time evolution in the Schrodinger equation. So well, we could get around this difficulty because there's not a unique single notion of time in special relativity. So we could choose one version of time to be our parameter. And so we could use proper time. And that would work. But we could also use some function of proper time. And so that, I'll come back to that. So we could do that. And then we would have an operator that we could position in time operators that we could combine into a four vector. Like this, there are functions of proper time. And we could add a parameter if we wanted, since we already have operators that depend on some parameter. We add an extra parameter that corresponds to length, then basically this is the starting point for string theory. So this would work. We'll end up with the same theory. It turns out to be complicated. Because we could also could use some function of proper time instead of proper time as our parameter. So we're not going to take this approach, although you will see some version of this later in the year if you do take the string theory course. We're going to take the opposite approach. And instead of promoting time to an operator, we're going to demote position to a parameter. This approach, the main advantage of being simpler. And so in this case, position is a label on fields. And I won't discuss any version of a position operator. We won't really need it. So position is going to take a very different role from what you're used to, and quantum mechanics is just going to be a label on fields. Okay, so that's some broad motivation for why we want to study quantum field theory. And a few of the things we'll learn at a high level from studying quantum field theory. So I want to get a little bit more concrete about where we're going over the next few weeks. So our biggest goal is to unify special relativity and quantum mechanics, and we'll do that. A more concrete goal that will be the subject of a large fraction of the course, is to learn how to calculate observables using perturbation theory. So, or the basically the quantities of interest in quantum field theory. So here are these M here denotes the matrix elements. It's an amplitude, so one of the basically the building blocks of quantum field theory. If we can calculate any amplitude we like, we can basically know everything we'd like to know about the quantum field theory, just about. Other observable quantities we'll learn how to calculate are cross sections or decay rates. The cross section is the relevant observable quantity if we're interested in scattering, or a decay rate if we have an unstable particle, calculate its lifetime. Okay, so that's most, although not all, of our time will be spent developing perturbation theory. And so where we're going for the rest of the course. So first, so the first half of today's lecture was an introduction. And we'll spend the second half of today's lecture developing some classical field theory. So you've seen some classical field theory in the front end. We'll have a lightning review, and then we'll solve a particular theory that will be of interest later in the course. Tomorrow, we will canonically quantize our first quantum field theory. It's going to be the simplest quantum field theory we can imagine. It'll be a free scalar. Field, a spin zero particle with no interactions. And even for this very simple field theory, we'll run into some surprises. Then on Thursday, we'll discuss cross sections and decay rates. And beginning next week, we'll learn how to calculate this amplitude. It will take us a few lectures. So the first thing we'll do is on Monday next week, we'll discuss the Lehmann Szymanczyk Zimmermann theorem, reduction formula, which is an important key step in being able to calculate an amplitude in quantum field theory. And on Tuesday next week, we'll complete our calculation of the amplitude. Discuss the interaction picture known as Wick's theorem, and we'll compute the propagator. And Thursday next week, we'll look at a visual and faster way of repeating calculation we'll do at the beginning of next week. Feynman diagrams are a powerful tool for studying Feynman, for studying quantum field theories, and we'll learn how that works. And in my final lecture, before I hand things over to Gong, we'll discuss briefly what's going to happen when we go beyond leading order. So most of the course will focus on calculating things at leading order. A number of interesting effects only show up once you go beyond leading order. So one of them is renormalization. So the fact that the coupling constants in quantum field theories depend on energy. So that's a very important effect that we'll see a little bit of in my final lecture and in the statistical mechanics course in QFT2. We'll go into a lot more detail about what happens beyond leading order. So that is an outline of my half of the course. And I'm going to focus exclusively on spin zero. And then John will take over and describe quantum field theories of spin half and spin one particles. Any questions on so far? Okay, so in the second part of lecture, I'll have a lightning review of relevant classical field theory you learned in David's course earlier in the year. And then we will solve the Klein-Gordon equation. So Klein-Gordon field is the name of the pre-scalar field theory that we're going to study today and tomorrow. It's going to be a first example of a quantum field theory, the simplest possible quantum field theory, and it will be useful in our study of more interesting interacting field theories. We're basically, when we have an interacting field theory, we're going to break it up into a pre-part. It's the part we're going to begin to study today, and an interacting part, which will create as a perturbation. So most of what we need from classical field theory, and it's not going to be a lot, we can remember just by thinking about either thinking about an analogy or thinking about quantum field theory as a limit of multi-particle classical mechanics. So our basic object of study is going to be a scalar field is a function of space-time. Sometimes we'll be able to treat all of the four coordinates together. Other times it'll be useful to break out time separately. So these mean the same thing. Again, the no vector symbol on top means it's a four vector. And so we can think of the four space-time coordinates as labels. Remember our approach to quantum field theory, position is a label, not an operator. And so in that sense, a quantum field or a classical field is just an object that takes a value at every point in space and time. So we can think about it as a either a continuum limit or just by an analogy. So in classical particle mechanics, we could have some finite number of generalized coordinates. And so in the analogy, the labels on the coordinates are like the position, or if we're taking, considering this as a continuum limit, if we just have a lattice, if we take more and more densely stacked points, we can have some generalized coordinate at each point in space. And the action here is just be the integral over time, some Lagrangian that usually would just depend on Q and Q dot. The analogous or continuum limit of that for here, some Lagrangian density depends on the field, and the first derivative of the field, we want to have four derivatives instead of just the time derivative if we want to have any hope of constructing a Lorentz invariant theory. And so since we're going to canonically quantize our theory, basically what we need to do is promote the field and its conjugate momentum to operators. Particle mechanics, the conjugate momentum is just the derivative Lagrangian with respect to Q dot. Same thing over here. And this is one place in which we're treating time and space a little bit differently. So over here, this is just a dot, not a four derivative. So we are separating out time and space. And we'll need to be careful that this slight asymmetric treatment of time and space doesn't spoil our Lorentz invariance of our theory. And other quantities can be constructed just exactly as you would expect them. Remembering just to think about position as a label based on this analogy. Klein-Gordon theory. It's going to be one of our main objects of study over the next several days. So Klein-Gordon theory is just another name for free scalar field theory. And the Lagrangian takes this form. And since we're eventually going to be quantizing this theory, it'll be useful to compute the momentum and Hamiltonian. So to compute the momentum, it's just the derivative with respect to phi dot. Remembering we're using the West Coast metric, so this is 1/2 phi dot squared minus 1/2 grad 3 grad phi squared minus 1/2 times square phi squared. And so phi is just partial derivative L with respect to phi dot, which is just phi dot. The Hamiltonian, our Hamiltonian density, as you'd expect, is just phi phi dot minus L, which is, so phi dot is phi, so this is phi squared minus 1/2 phi squared plus 1/2 grad phi squared plus 1/2 times squared phi squared. These combine to give us 1/2 phi squared. And the last bit of classical field theory we'll need is the equation of motion, or Euler-Lagrange equation. And that takes the form L d phi minus the derivative of L d mu phi. And if we compute these things, so L d phi gives us just this term minus m squared phi. And we take the derivative with respect to d mu phi, we just get d mu phi. So that's our Euler-Lagrange equation. And we can rewrite it in a slightly nicer form. And we'll solve this in a few minutes. This is most of the classical field theory we'll need for this course. Study a few other theories. Basically, we'll just need enough classical field theory to determine the equations of motion, the momentum, and Hamiltonian. There's one exception, one other piece of classical field theory will be useful. And that's Noether's theorem. This is the subject of first homework, so be sure to get that in on time if you haven't looked at that yet. I'm going to use a slightly different version of Noether's theorem than David did. They're equivalent, as you'll show in the homework. So Noether's theorem basically says that for every continuous symmetry, there's a conserved current. And if there's a conserved current, there's also a conserved charge. So what does it mean for for it to be a continuous symmetry, it means there's a symmetry that you can make infinitesimally. So we can there's a continuous symmetry, there's some parameter that describes how much of a rotation or generalized rotation you're performing to your system. So it means there's some variation due to our field. We'll suppose is some y, which might depend on the field under which the Lagrangian changes only up to a total derivative. And conserved current means that there's some j mu whose divergence vanishes. And Noether's theorem not only tells you that there is a conserved current, it gives you a formula for the current. And in the notation we'll use in this course, j is given by this. And you'll, yeah, again, in your homework, you'll examine the relationship between this version and what you've seen before. And yeah, the conserved charge, typically denoted as Q, it's just the integral over space, the zeroth component of the current. I'm not going to prove this. That's in your homework, and you've also seen it in David's course. But we will be using this result at times throughout this course. And you may be wondering why we're justified in doing that. After all, this is a classical result. Nevertheless, we are going to use it to study quantum field theories. After all, conserved currents and conserved charges are powerful tools. They can tell us a lot about the dynamics without a lot of work. They're important. Symmetries are very important for understanding quantum field theories in general. We're going to use Noether's theorem. But you should be very skeptical. Your derivation is entirely classical, and there is absolutely no guarantee that this current, which is conserved in the classical theory, should be conserved in the quantum theory. And in fact, in general, it's not.
In general, not true that a charge or current that's conserved in the classical theory is also conserved in the quantum theory. It's often true. Most of the examples we'll look at in this course and QFT2 will be true. But in general, there can be quantum effects that we'll study more in QFT3. So I'm not going to give you make wrong statements in this course on QFT2, but we will refer the justification for which currents or charges are study in these two courses, for the most part, won't have anomalies, or won't, at least won't have anomalies for the symmetries that we'll talk about. So the result will be correct, but there's an important caveat that we'll come to only in year D3. Any questions on the statement? Just go through a very quick example how to use it. Suppose you've got different field theory. Complex scalar field. So and P here is some function that depends only on the module squared field. And this theory has a natural symmetry. If we rotate the phase, change the phase of the field. This depends on the modulus, so that's clearly independent. This term will pick up e to the f theta, but phi star, this conjugate, should pick up the opposite phase, and so theory should be there. This is a symmetry, so U1 symmetry, we're calling Hibbs force. And to use Noether's theorem in the form that I've given it, we need the infinitesimal symmetries. So the infinitesimal version of these two equations are d phi as I theta phi, and d phi star is minus I theta. And as I just argued, the Lagrangian is under, so that is 0. And so we can just read off and we conserve current. So just be the derivative of Lagrangian with respect to phi, d phi. So consider both of our variations. So we get two terms here. And each of these derivatives can evaluate very simply. I theta phi is d phi. So this derivative just gives us d mu phi star. And the same thing over here. And because theta is just is arbitrary, we can get rid of that. Also, get rid of the I, it's just a constant. If constant times current is conserved, get rid of the constant, it's also conserved. So, we can also just write it as. That's our concept of current. And this is, in a sense, the second simplest field theory, at least if we choose a simple form of B. It's a complex scalar field. We'll study that more later. The conserved charge associated with this symmetry has a couple of interpretations that we'll discuss more. The particle number for electric charge. We'll come back to that. Any questions on?
So isn't there only one current just because they're not independent of each other?
That's right. If we do this rotation, we also have to rotate by stuff. If there's one current associated with each symmetry, it doesn't matter how many fields there are. We'll look at examples later in the year where we've got, say, five different fields that all transform in their own ways under a single symmetry. And there's just one current then that depends on all those fields. Is Okay. So that it works, but if you want to compare it off to apply it, K is useful to make change of variables K plus or minus K. So we can compare phi star of otherwise the exponents will different. In phi we have the positive exponent here. Straightforward to change k to minus k here and here. And what about the measure? So we change k to minus k. We pick up a minus sign for each of the directions, but we also pick up an extra minus sign for flipping the integration. So the measure doesn't change under this change of coordinates. So we can just flip the sign of k in the integrand. And phi equals phi star, alpha equals phi e k equals phi star of p minus k. So as we compare phi to phi star, the only difference is in the integrand on the half phi. For a transform by EK by star. And so that then tells us that B equals A star.
The second line on the left-hand side of the blackboard. Mm-hmm. Blackboard equation. Should it be double dot instead of dot squared?
Yes. Yes, this is the nicely combine into a four vector in the way we've written it. But we can do this k goes to minus k, correct? Number 4. So if the k goes to minus k here, as before, the measure doesn't change. It's an even number of minus signs, so we can just, in even rank, put k to minus k. And then this term can also be written in the orbit, as a four vector. So a product of four vectors. So this will be our final form for today, and we're going to deal with it a little bit more tomorrow. So we see here, as that solution on Gordon equation can be written in this form. With product of four vectors in the exponent. Turns out this is not the best normalization of our solution, so we'll change our normalization of this era. But apart from that, this will be the form of this solution that we're going to use to quantize the theory. So what we're going to do tomorrow, we're going to quantize a few of operators, and that's going to mean, so this is an operator, something on the right-hand side is going to be an operator. You know, position and time are just labels. K is an integration variable, so that means that A and S are not the operators. These are going to be ladder operators that create and annihilate the process. So we'll see how that works. That's up here for today. Just a reminder that homework one is out and the first part is due tomorrow. So if you want to get that, otherwise we'll resume tomorrow, but on the